Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA.
Welcome to Current State here on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. Coming up later on the show, we are going to look at Ingham County Animal Control and some of the issues they face. Also, we're looking at access to veterans in Michigan. But first, grocery stores have been making the news in Detroit recently. Last week, the Michigan-based retailer Meijer's opened its first Detroit location. This follows the news last month of the grand opening of the city's first Whole Foods market. Based on these stories, one might think Detroiters were only recently introduced to the concept of the grocery store. We know that's not true. So what's going on with Detroit's food supply? Here to give us more of a sense of the food situation in Detroit, as well as here in mid-Michigan, is Craig Harris. He's an MSU Associate Professor of Sociology who specializes in the sociology of food. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
So these grocery store openings in Detroit, first there's Whole Foods, now we have Meijer's. This is big news for some reason, which does seem kind of strange. Why is this big news?
Well, it's big news for a couple reasons. First of all, as you suggested in your initial comment, we did not used to think a great deal about Detroit as being a city with a great deal of food insecurity in the sense that we talk now about food deserts, large areas of a city or of a rural region where people live at great distances from a store carrying a full line of food, not only processed foods, but also fresh fruits and vegetables. Thinking about the history of Detroit over the past couple decades, there used to be more Farmer Jack's stores there, other Michigan and regional chain stores there that gradually closed, leaving areas of the city without a what we think of as at least a supermarket, a larger grocery store. And about 10 years ago, United States Department of Agriculture began paying attention to this and popularizing the term food desert as a way of thinking about areas in the United States, and in our case, especially in Michigan, where people lived, where a large number of people lived more than a mile, more than half a mile away from a supermarket, a full-line grocery store. And that this was a problem that then led people to have to depend on perhaps fast food outlets, very reduced variety of foods available to them, especially fresh fruits and vegetables, and this was seen as a significant health problem. There's been a lot of discussion about this in Detroit because defining the food desert that way essentially ignores the local neighborhood stores that may not be carrying a full, what we think of as a full line of groceries, but may nevertheless be carrying a good variety of processed foods and some fruits and vegetables.
So these big box stores aren't coming in and saving and giving them the only food available in the area. There is some access out there.
There is access. And another thing that has gone on in Detroit and in many other cities is that more and more people are using both their backyards, their front yards, and to have their own gardens, and then are using vacant lots in their neighborhoods to have community gardens. And so one of the things that the Detroit Food Council has really pushed and the Detroit Black Food Security Council also, is to provide more support, more assistance to people who are wanting to raise their own food, again, especially fresh vegetables, and to do that rather than saying, okay, how do we bring in a big box store, exactly as you're saying, that then is going to be the salvation of the food system. And so enabling people to produce more of their own food and, I would argue, strengthening those local neighborhood stores that are still there are also very important ways of ensuring that people have access to a good variety of fresh and safe and nutritious food.
Now, I want to back up a little bit. You already kind of discussed it, but what does a food desert exactly look like? And how, I guess, does a food desert in Detroit compare to, say, a food desert here in Lansing or, mm-hmm. or in Flint?
Well, as the U.S. Department of Agriculture has defined the term and modified that definition over the years, it is in terms of distance from a full-line grocery store. And so once you have a significant area, perhaps 10 blocks or so, 10 to 20 blocks, that is more than half a mile or more than a mile away from a full-service grocery store, that is considered a food desert. Now, you said, well, what does a food desert look like? Well, this is, I think, where it gets interesting, because to go to those areas that are marked on a map, a USDA map, as food deserts, and walk around, drive around, you do see many of these smaller neighborhood stores, corner stores. You see many community gardens, and indeed some of the larger fresh food growing efforts, the Capuchin Garden in Detroit and others, and you say, well, you know, this really isn't a food desert. There is lots of good food here, and so that I think is part of the discussion that goes on. And in terms of Lansing, the problems of Lansing are certainly nowhere near as great as the food access problems in Detroit. But there are areas of Lansing that in the past decade have had great distance from a full variety store. One of the things that's happened in Lansing and in Detroit and Flint is that neighborhood farmers markets have been created. So in Lansing, one of the biggest things going is the Allen Street Market that, again, was, as defined, conceptualized, a food desert, and a group of people both in the neighborhood and outside the neighborhood got together and said, okay, how do we make a cooperative market? How do we make a farmer's market there? And over the past several years, they have built up the Allen Street Farmers Market to the point that it now does provide fresh fruits and vegetables, meat, dairy products that are grown here in the region, produced here in the region, and available at very affordable prices to the people. And the people in that neighborhood then are able to walk to that market. It's every week. So you can count on it being there. You can count on the products being there. And again, that's a way of thinking about how do we work together to solve the problem of food security, food access, rather than saying, okay, how do we get some big transnational to come in and build a store?
Well, is having access to a store, having access to a farmer's market enough? Is the access the only part of the problem, or is there also educational facets or breaking of bad habits in those cases as well?
Mm-hmm. Like all problems, it's complex, it's multidimensional. Education is certainly a part of it, and indeed groups like the Allen Street Market, like the Detroit Black Food Security Council, do have educational programming as part of what they do. I would, and so certainly it is habits, but again, these are habits that have been created by the lack of access to a good variety of food. In Detroit, and to a greater extent than Lansing, but also for Flint and Lansing, the problems of income, problems of employment, unemployment, problems of income. So at the moment in Detroit, roughly a third of Detroit people are living below what the government defines as poverty level. Roughly 60% of children in Detroit are living in households that are below the poverty level. So even when a full-line grocery store is there, if you don't have money, you don't have access.
Yeah.
And so one of the statistics that we do look at is what the USDA defines as food insecurity. Roughly 25% of Detroit households have a moderate level of food insecurity. At least once a month, they do not have access to the food that they need to have a regular, just a basic diet. Roughly 10% of Detroit households have severe food insecurity. Several times a month, every month, they do not have enough food. And so that's, again, as you're saying, a combination of income as well as a combination of the existence of stores, existence of sources of food, either growing themselves or commercially purchased.
You've kind of touched on it there, but can you expand a little bit about why food security is important?
Well, I think it's important for several reasons. Perhaps one of the most important is the link between a good diet and not only good health generally, but especially for children, good development, both mental development and physical development. And so I think that is part of what is just so compelling about a piece of data like 60% of the Detroit children are below the poverty level, 50% of Detroit children are moderately food insecure. So this means that they're not getting the food they need for their bodies and their minds to grow and develop through this period of childhood. Which means that they then will enter adulthood with those kinds of restricted abilities that come from the reduced development of their childhood. In addition to that, we would like to think that we live in a country where when we see somebody with a basic need, like food or housing, food, water, housing, the basic mm-hmm. necessities, that as a society we take care of that. And to look at a situation where you have high levels of food insecurity, I think raises questions about our society and about our social order. And have we lost some of that sense of taking care of each other so that we all have the basic necessities that we need.
Well, Craig, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Craig Harris is an MSU Associate Professor of Sociology at the Center for Regional Food Systems and the Ag Bio Research Station. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
And now we bring you another public poetry announcement.
The Bean Eaters by Gwendolyn Brooks. They eat beans mostly, this old yellow pair. Dinner is a casual affair. Plain chipware on a plain and creaking wood. Tin flatware. Two who are mostly good. Two who have lived their day but keep on putting on their clothes and putting things away. And remembering with twinklings and twinges as they lean over the beans in their rented back room that is full of beads and receipts and dolls and cloths, tobacco crumbs, vases, and fringes. The Bean Eaters by Gwendolyn Brooks. For Current State, I'm Stephanie Glazier.
From pet hoarding to dog fighting to stray cats and dogs, if it has four legs and a problem, chances are the Ingham County Animal Control Division will be called in to help. Today, we thought we'd explore just what issues plague our animal population with Jamie McLoon-Lampman. She's the director of Ingham County's Animal Control. Welcome, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi. So could you start kind of by telling us what are some of the major animal control responsibilities that you deal with in Ingham County?
Well, predominantly we're there to protect people, but also to protect pets. So we're protecting both of them from each other, more or less. In addition to being the law enforcement entity in animal welfare in Ingham County, we're also a sheltering entity. We provide shelter and care for approximately about 2 to 220 animals on any given day here in Ingham County at our shelter. So it's two big jobs in one.
So a few years back, there was a significant problem with dog fighting in the county. What's the situation like now? Are you still finding a lot of abused dogs who were used in fighting?
Well, the dog fighting definitely has seen a decline in Ingham County. That's not to say that it's not still out there in all our bordering counties, because they just seem to have just gone past that county line where we can't touch them. So we still are seeing the remnants of dog fighting. We've got a lot of people in Ingham County that are still breeding pit bulls for the purpose of selling them to dog fighters or to train them in dog fighting. But the big dog fighting rings that we once had 5 to 8 years ago pretty much are gone. A lot of them are in prison, dead, or have moved on. But like I said, there's still what we call the hobbyists, and these are the teenagers that are out there having some of the fights set up in their garages, the parks, and some of the alleyways, things like that, just kind of hit and miss fights. But still, the end result is pretty bad. You have an animal that's brutally hurt, sometimes dead, and left behind with no care, and we usually pick those animals up.
And what are some of the, when you pick those animals up, what are some of the issues that I guess they have to overcome? Are they typically rehabilitated? And
Some are, but many can't be. And that's because the aggression level is so high. What makes a fighting dog a good fighting dog is a heavy prey drive, but I mean a just very heavy prey drive, where they are so focused they want to get that animal at all costs. They're willing to fight at all costs. They're willing to continue in a fight with a broken leg, an eye missing, an ear torn. 40 minutes into a fight, they're still going at it. That's a game dog. That's a dog that any fighter is going to want, and they're going to want to breed it also to sell those puppies, because gameness in a dog is the most valuable commodity in a dog. Many of these street level fights that we find, these are just pets sometimes. I mean, these dogs really aren't fighters. You might get one that's got some game in it, and they're fighting it with somebody else's beloved pit bull that has no intention of fighting. And that's the saddest part at all, when these animals are subjected to that, or somebody steals a dog for the purpose of fighting, which is called a bait dog. Those are the sad ones. Often when we pick them up, they're severely injured. Sometimes they're dead, of course. We can rehabilitate some of them, the ones that don't have that heavy prey drive, but I would say it's about a 50-50 on those. But yeah, a lot of medical care goes into those dogs to get them to recover if they're going to be suitable for rehoming. If they're not suitable for rehoming, they're humanely euthanized.
You mentioned pit bulls there, and I feel like a lot of people associate fighting dogs
yes.
with pit bulls.
And they shouldn't.
And yeah, talk about that a little bit.
You know, they shouldn't. It's actually a smaller percentage that actually are the fighting dogs, but yet those dogs are taking all the attention. Anytime there's a child attacked or another fight occurs, it's always a pit bull is predominantly what they promote on there. And it's true, it's the most popular dog right now. Everybody wants one. Everyone has one. It seems like all the wrong people have them as well. They seem to be the biggest draw for the wrong type of pet owners. So those are the ones that are neglectful, bad pet owners. Let them run at large. Let them breed at random. And don't care for them. And they're often abandoned. Pit bulls in the Lansing area are the number one stolen dog. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do, but we are seeing some results of some of the programs that we do. We've got a pit stop program where you can spay or neuter pit bulls for a fairly cheap price. And so we're seeing a decline. I mean, when I got there, it was probably 80% pit bulls at our shelter. That was almost 9 years ago. Now we're down to probably about 60%, and that's declining. So that's significant. We're seeing that decline. People are spaying and neutering and getting smart about training their dogs and telling us when there's some bad pit. Not pit bull owners, but dog pet owners are being reported more.
You mentioned dog theft there. Is that something that's a common issue that you deal with?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's really common, but we do have stolen dogs in Lansing. But of the dogs that we get reported as stolen, pit bull seems to be a higher percentage, certainly. We have a lost and found registry at our shelter, so we keep track of all the animals in Ingham County that are lost or missing or found. A lot of people find the dogs and report that they found them and keep them in their homes until they can either rehome them or find the owner. By law, they have to hang on to them for the 7 days and notify a local agency that they have them. So if an owner calls, we have that information.
What are some of the other major problems that you encounter?
Well, irresponsible pet owners is the biggest one, and that's the people who don't take care of their pets properly. I would say hoarders are a big issue for us. We deal with that every day. It's when we go into a house and we don't find one or two cats, we find 50 to 75 cats, and they're all in horrible condition. Or we find 35 dogs in a house, something like that. That's not uncommon. And like I said, it happens every day. I mean, this past month, it's been brutal for us. You know, we had one place where we took 31 dogs and 9 cats out of one home. We had, you know, not, but maybe 2 weeks later, we took another 40 cats out of another home. So those really put a lot of pressure on us as a shelter that has limited capacity to be able to get through that and not euthanize animals because of lack of space. We try very hard to make sure we get animals placed as much as possible. So we've got to move quickly, you know. So hoarding cases are really hard on animal shelters.
And how typically when there's a hoarding case, how is that reported? Does someone notice, hey, this person's got 50 cats over here and call it in?
Or? It comes from all different places. It comes from the mailman who says the stench on the front porch is so bad he can hardly deliver the mail there anymore, to the cable guy, to the utility workers, to the neighbor next door who's just simply tired of all those cats running across their yard or dead cats in the road, that sort of thing. A family member who just says, I've had enough. Someone needs to, you know, do some intervention here. Schools, the children come to school, they smell bad, and they tell them how they have, you know, 15 dogs. You know, it's a lot of different resources, and people need to report that to us because we've often been able to get in and do some intervention, which also helped the children in the household as well, because the kids are living in that environment as well. Mm-hmm. Senior citizens are living in those environments as well. So, you know, pet problems are people problems. There's always a human associated with that problem, and they often need help as well.
What about exotic pets? Do you have any issues with exotic pets here?
You know, we don't. Nah, not really. It's really mine. Thank God, because I worked for 19 years in Oklahoma, and that was a real issue down there. I mean, it was not unusual to deal with cougars and leopards and tigers and things like that. They were very common at the auctions. They call them the live auctions down there, and they were fairly cheap. So I'm just blessed that I don't have to deal with that up here, because it's a nightmare. You really have to know what you're doing. Rehoming those animals is so difficult, because all the sanctuaries that house those exotics are full. And so it's very difficult when you have that problem. So right now, I wouldn't say that's much of a problem on our take.
You said you worked in Oklahoma. What was it like working in Oklahoma compared to here, beyond the exotic pets? Were there any other major differences?
No. When I was in Oklahoma, it was a no-kill shelter down there, and we did most of the investigations for several counties in the area. We did the cruelty investigations. So we dealt with a lot of horses. At that time, ostrich was the new white meat, so there was a lot of ostriches farms going under at the time because they really weren't the new white meat. No one was buying it, so we were dealing with a lot of abandoned ostriches and emus, and so rounding those up was always a challenge. But I was in Norman, Oklahoma, which is a very progressive area of Oklahoma. So it was a great experience, but it was a little different in the fact that some of the animals were different.
What are some of the stranger cases you've dealt with in Ingham County?
I don't know. Strange is. I don't know. I mean, there's so many. I mean, I'm going on almost 27 years in this business, and nothing surprises me anymore. I couldn't say that I've had a very strange one. I've had a lot of very interesting ones, and the ones that deal with the children and the animals are probably the hardest ones to take. Mm-hmm. Our officers knock on a lot of doors, and those doors often have felons behind it. They have domestic violence going on behind it, child abuse. So, there's just so many different areas that we touch on that people don't understand with animal control. And it's a valued service that the officers are highly skilled, and they should be in all animal control agencies, which is not necessarily the case. We don't put a lot of resources through the state of Michigan and our animal control officers as Ingham County does. Ingham County is quite an exception, in my opinion.
How'd you get into this business?
I was writing a story. I was at the School of Journalism at the Oklahoma University, and I did a story on animal shelters. That's how I started. But I was putting myself through college as a veterinary technician. So just one thing led to the other. So yeah, just a great interest in it, passion for it. Just always wanting to do everything we can to get those animals out the front door.
And Jamie McAloom-Lampman is the director of Ingham County Animal Control. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
You.
Since the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001, the United States has deployed nearly 2 million military personnel to Iraq and Afghanistan. As operations wind down, thousands of troops are returning home, many with profound physical and psychological wounds. The influx is straining the nation's resources. The Department of Veterans Affairs is struggling to fill a backlog of some 816,000 disability claims. Ironically, Michigan ranks last in the nation's terms of VA benefits spending per person. But many who do seek help from the government are frustrated with long waiting periods that often yield little result. Some are turning to veteran support groups for help. Current State's Kevin Lavery has the story.
Like millions of us who remember 9/11, Eric Calley can tell you exactly where he was that fateful morning.
I was at Grand Valley State University in their launch room when the towers hit in September, and I knew that was my calling. I never went back to school.
Calley joined the Marine Corps in early 2002. He did boot camp in San Diego and infantry school in the Mojave Desert. Then came a unique assignment. Calley was ordered to the personal security detail of General James Conway, who at the time commanded the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in Iraq. Calley was part of the first wave into Baghdad when the invasion began in March 2003. It wasn't long before Calley tasted the chaos of war.
They would fire at us from one location, drop their stuff and dress in plain clothes and walk down the road, and then we couldn't touch them because they didn't have a weapon on them. And so you never know who your enemy is, and you don't know when your time might be short. You get into that combat mode so much that that's all you think about, live, eat, and breathe, is let's go kill people.
Calley's first tour in Iraq was traumatic. His second was worse. A fight with a sergeant whom Calley believed put his unit in danger earned him a court-martial and cost him a stripe. Even so, he was honorably discharged in 2006. But by then, the heavy drinking and occasional suicidal thoughts had already begun. Calley was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He filed a claim with the VA, but it took 2.5 years to get a disability rating. He's since been upgraded, and now Eric Calley is doing better. So much better, in fact, that he's since co-founded a grassroots advocacy group called The Fight Continues. Calley characterizes it as a stand against suicide. One-on-one, vets visit vets in their own homes where they're most isolated and vulnerable. Then they try to match them up with the right treatment programs. These missions of mercy aren't always easy.
A lot of our intel on these people come from grandmothers, friends, you know, guys that say, hey, you know, this guy hasn't left his house in 3-4 months. I've been kicked out of a house 4 times, and it doesn't stop us from going back. You know, you never give up on your family, and the military is a part of my family.
Michelle Rudzidas is part of his extended family. She also served in Iraq in a military police company. One night in January 2007, Rudzidas, two other soldiers, and their interpreter were riding in a Humvee outside Baghdad on a section of highway notorious for roadside bombs.
So we just passed the spot and did a, you know, thank goodness. And Brandon said, I love you, Derek. And Derek said, I love you, man. And I was looking out the window, straightening up in my seat, and the bomb went off.
Derek survived. Brandon and the interpreter, nicknamed Kevin, did not. The explosion claimed Rudzidas' left leg, and doctors worked feverishly to save her right. To say the last 6 years of her life have been hard would be a gross understatement. Like Callie, she also suffers from PTSD. She was heavily medicated the first 4 years. After 10 years of service, Rudzidas gets just $300 a month from the Army, and she feels she's lost in a maze of shuffled paperwork and unreturned phone calls.
It's either they're overwhelmed, they don't care. I mean, it's just a multitude of reasons why vets aren't getting the kind of help that they need. But it's just constant sloughing off, or they'll just give you some lip service and get you out the door. And then, you know, weeks and weeks go by and you don't hear anything.
I understand the frustration sometimes.
Damian McGee is the public affairs officer for the VA Medical Center in Battle Creek and a veteran himself. He says the VA is divided into two parts, one for benefits, the other for health care. The benefits side has to assess a veteran's condition before the treatment can begin.
I think a lot of people might be under the misconception that, you know, you have an injury that you believe is service-connected and you walk into the VA hospital and we can somehow automatically connect that to a service injury, and that's not how the process works.
McGee dissuades veterans from going it alone. He says the best route is to find a veteran service officer to help them navigate the system.
It never hurts to have a second or even a third set of eyes. Look at what you're submitting. Look at your paperwork. Tell you if you're missing something. Because the frustrating part is if you get it put together and you send it in and you're missing something, you kind of start over again.
Veteran service officers are found in agencies like the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Disabled American Veterans, and the American Legion. Ray Moore commands the American Legion Department of Michigan, which represents 70,000 members. His agency shares office space with the VA in Detroit, which on some levels aids communication. Moore says the American Legion electronically tracks their clients' claims.
We try to package the claim so that it is complete when it goes in. The VA doesn't have to ask for any additional information. But as far as a time frame, any claim that is submitted to the VA now, we're looking at anywhere from possibly 10 to 12 months before we get any kind of a decision, right, wrong, or indifferent.
That turnaround time represents a concerted effort by the VA to overhaul its infamous bureaucracy. Michelle Rudzidas has heard horror stories of veterans who waited far longer on Uncle Sam than she has.
I met a gentleman, his father served, I believe, World War II, had been applying for benefits his whole entire life. He was 88 years old, was approved for his benefits, and died 3 days later.
The VA is promising in its latest strategic plan to resolve all claims pending more than 125 days by the end of 2015. And it pledges to do so with a 98% accuracy rate. It's a big job and a race against time. America is trying to deliver on the promises it has made to warriors young and old. As the 9/11 generation comes home, we're losing 600 from the Pearl Harbor generation every day. For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery. We'll be right back.
This is Current State on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry. Michigan's economy and culture has been positively impacted by the craft beer and wine industry. But if beer or wine isn't your style, don't fret. Michigan is one of the most small distiller-friendly states in the nation, and as a result, the state's spirit industry is growing. Chris Berglung is an MSU Distinguished Professor of Food Science and Chemical Engineering. He's also one of the leaders in the craft distillers movement. Chris, welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much.
So before 2008, it was illegal for distillers to sell their product on site in Michigan, and that law has now been changed. Tell us a little bit about your role in getting that legislation moved or so that you can do that on site now.
Sure. I think the overall passage of the bill was a pretty good example about how things could actually work. I have been working in this field for a long time, and we kind of recognized that there was this problem of not being able to make particularly grain-based spirits and sell them on premises. And so I contacted Barb Byram, who is the representative for one of the Ingham County districts here, and discussed it with her. And she agreed to shepherd a bill of this nature through the legislature. I explained to her what the problems are. The Byram family, Diane, of course, is the trustee at MSU, are well known about small business, and so they recognized that this was important. So basically, Barb helped put together. I helped her, you know, with some of the details, but she did a lot of the politics and got, you know, a bunch of the different people at the table. To do that, we had a bunch of hearings we went to. We had a lot of meetings, but pretty much everybody who had an interest had some input in the process. And by the time it was all done, it went before the Senate and the House committees. The hearings were held. It was unanimous. Nobody changed any of the wording in the bill, which is actually remarkable. It was unanimous in the House, and it passed 35-3 in the Senate. And then Governor Granholm signed it. So it took us about a year to do it, but all the people that had an interest in it had a place at the table, and were able to have input. And it actually, most of the input that people had in there made it a much better bill by the end of the day.
So how has this change in legislation impacted the local distillery scene?
Well, we're seeing a pretty strong growth at this point, and it's because of the fact you can actually have effectively like a cocktail bar on premises with your distillery and not have to get a liquor license. That's the key thing. And so we've seen in the southeast part of Michigan, we're starting to see quite a bit of growth. We have Ruffino Valentine in Ferndale that has this sort of thing. Two Jameses is going into Corktown. They're going to open up maybe in the next month or so. Detroit City Distillery is going to open up in the East Market, so we're seeing a lot of movement in the southeast part. But predominantly, most of the other action has actually been in the central and western parts of the state, but now we're seeing it migrate to southeast Michigan, which I think is really positive. Put this in perspective, in 1996, we had zero small distillers in the state of Michigan. And as of last week, I think we had over 30 licenses that have been issued by the state. That doesn't mean there's 30 distilleries, but they have 30 licenses, and that's one way to count them. But it does give you some idea. There is a rate of growth that's sort of parallels what's happening in the microbrewing and the small winery businesses.
Did you anticipate that there would be this much growth?
Yes, I think we did. And part of the reason is that many of the people that are entering this business are already a wine producer or a brewer. And so they're already familiar with this industry, and so their success rate's going to be higher, and they're not novices to this type of business. And so we kind of anticipated that in just the discussions with people, that if they could see an opportunity to actually sell spirits on site with their microbrewery, let's say, that was a nice opportunity for them, and that people were going to get into that business. So it's not particularly surprising that we're seeing that level of growth, and it looks like it's going to continue for quite some time.
So as this industry keeps on growing, how big of an economic impact do you foresee it having throughout the state of Michigan?
Well, it should have some pretty significant. I mean, it should be eventually get into the hundreds of millions kind of thing. It's a little bit like counting chickens, though, because too often people have more than one license, and how you separate out the two. It's often that the sum of the whole is more than the sum of the parts, if you know what I mean. And so the overall business that people generate by having distilleries with the winery may make both of the enterprises go bigger. So sometimes it's a little bit hard, but I don't think there's any question that we can get into the fairly significant amount of money in terms of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. That's not even a very large fraction of the Michigan beverage industry. So any kind of reasonable penetration, if we could get to 3 to 4 to 5% penetration, that's going to be a very significant number.
You mentioned two distilleries that are located kind of in the Detroit area. Do you see that playing a role at all in Detroit's kind of resurgence, becoming a spot for distilleries?
I think it is. I mean, I think there's somebody else was just talking to me in the same area. They haven't actually announced their distillery yet. So I know at least four are going to be down there pretty soon, and I suspect there'll be others that follow. But I do believe that's going to help some with Detroit.
One important thing to note about the law, or I think one of the most interesting things, is that it's really important, the idea that there's tasting rooms on sites, that you can have this on-site distilleries. Why is that experience important for both the consumer and the distiller to be able to have that spirit made?
Right. We've done that for a long time with wineries, and we do that with breweries as well. They let people do that. Spirits benefits even more by that, because if you look at a fifth of a spirit, let's say a fifth of vodka, it's likely that its purchase price is going to be in the $30 range, okay? Most people don't want to buy something worth $30 that they have no idea what's in the bottle. And so that's why having this ability on premises is really, really important. It also allows these small distillers to make some very specialty products that may not even be appropriate for distribution, but people will come there and see these special spirits and enjoy that experience as well. And so it's sort of a destination experience, and that's just like what we have here in East Lansing. Red Cedar Spirits is where we run the MSU program out of, and that's the same thing. People come there because they can see things and taste things that they just can't get anyplace else.
And you just mentioned it right there. MSU this year is launching a beverage science and technology specialization within their program. What do students who enroll in this program learn? What is this program all about?
The beverage science and technology specialization is designed to give people a relatively broad understanding of beverage manufacturing. And it's the main goal is that. So we have classes and micro, we have classes in horticulture, we have a class in food science, it's fermented beverages, we have a class in chemistry, which is the technology and science of winemaking, maybe the only chemistry class in the country that's taught at a major university's chemistry department, and then chemical engineering at MSU teaches brewing and distilling technology. So we have three different departments actively in three different colleges that are doing this. So what we anticipate, sort of a typical student will probably be someone majoring in food science, maybe micro, maybe chemistry, maybe chemical engineering, and they'll take these 15 credits as part of their program. And since they already have a really solid science background, this additional 15 credits really can go a very long way in preparing them to have some entry-level skills to work in these different industries.
And you mentioned that the brewery has this on-site tasting. Why is that an essential part of the learning experience for students?
Well, one of the things that we're doing in the tasting room at Red Cedar Spirits, and we're in the process of doing this, is working with hospitality business, because their students are in the hospitality side of things, and they will be some of the people that will be employed as interns in the tasting room. So they'll get some firsthand experience as well. It's always useful, though, for someone who's like a chemical engineer that knows how to make the spirits to actually know how to pour a cocktail, too. So, I mean, the continuum of things is actually useful, too. But it also lets us really emphasize the business elements of this business. And students really see, you know, where the money comes and where the money goes. And they understand the ins and outs if you see the full continuum of activities.
This may be a little bit of a loaded question, but what are some of your favorite local spirits?
They're all God's children as far as I'm concerned. And I don't really play favorites. Of course, we think ours are the best, but that's another story.
Of course, of course. Well, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Chris Berglund is a leader in the craft distiller movement and an MSU Distinguished Professor of Food Sciences and Chemical Engineering. Thanks again.
Thank you.
College football practice is starting at the end of this week. And to get us ready for the football season, we have Matt Ludke. He's a production assistant for Current State Sports. So let's talk football, Matt.
Oh, let's get into it. I've been waiting all summer, and we're finally here.
So looking at the Spartans, what are they going to maintain from last year that's going to be carried over to this year that's a positive or a plus?
Well, it's weird because it's kind of a tale of two teams. As far as the defense is concerned, we've been set for the last few seasons, like nationally elite. The last few seasons, they've been sixth and fourth in total defense in terms of the entire country. And I think you're going to see that carry over. I mean, they lose a few guys as far as defensive starters are concerned, but they return a majority of the defense, similar schemes and everything. They're going to do the same thing. I think you're going to see a lot of low-scoring games again this season. Hopefully they won't be quite as frustrating as they were last year, though.
They were very frustrating.
Very frustrating.
And offense seems to be where Michigan State struggled more than anything.
Yeah.
Does our offense look like it's going to be better this year, or are we not really sure yet?
Well, you know, it's one thing you can say, there's a lot of question marks, and that can be good and it can be bad. Last year they were so close, and you hear Coach D'Antonio say things like, you know, we're missing on the inches. He always sits talking about the inches. And when you look, I mean, five losses in the Big Ten by 13 points total, yeah, you're missing out on some of the inches. But at the same time, a majority of the offense last year was Le'Veon Bell. I mean, there's no way to mince words about it. He was 42% of the yards and 48% of the points. Like, talking about leaving a hole, that's quite a hole to fill. And I don't think it's going to be one guy. As far as the running back is concerned, I mean, you've got Max Bulla's little brother Riley filling in right now. A couple of freshmen are coming in. They're going to compete, but it's just they're looking for consistency because there were flashes where they were moving the ball last year, and then they'd have possessions where they moved back 30 yards because, you know, offensive penalties, you know, just miscues, just little things that they weren't quite up to snuff on, and, you know, they had to pay for it. And this year, you've got Andrew Maxwell coming back. He's the senior leader at quarterback. But at the end of the year, you know, it was Connor Cook playing in the bowl game. So how much confidence do they really have in Maxwell? And that's going to be the big question mark going in, is who's going to lead the offense, and are they going to be consistent this season? Whereas last year, it was up and down, up and down.
Last year, surprisingly, especially looking at Bell scoring, you know, 48% of the points, I think you just said, they actually passed more than they ran.
Yeah.
Do you think that game plan changes at all this year, or you think they're still going to stick to being more of a passing team?
I think part of that last year was Bell was the only guy who the coaches trusted. Yeah, and this year, they don't have that luxury. There's no security blanket, because Le'Veon Bell was pretty much a cure-all last year. If, you know, it was third and three, give it to Le'Veon. If it's third and five, give it to Le'Veon. If it's third and seven, give it to Le'Veon. Maybe have him throw. Who knows? You know, any way we could get him the ball, let's do it. And this year, there is no guy coming in who is the guy. So I think, you know, in some ways, it's a problem, but it's definitely an opportunity for multiple people. And traditionally, you know, they've been way more successful when they have multiple people contributing. Back when they were winning 11 games every season, it was, you know, Le'Veon Bell and Larry Caper and Edwin Baker as kind of like a three-headed monster. So when you get, you know, multiple guys contributing, I think it's easier to, you know, make up that yardage. I don't think anybody's going to have 1,800 yards rushing, and I don't think that Maxwell is going to throw quite as much because they're going to be able to spread the ball around to more ball carriers and get more people involved. And, you know, it's all about depth, and you can't just be a one-trick pony, especially in this day and age in college football. You have to be able to attack people on multiple fronts, and I think that's one of the things they're going to be looking for with all these young players. Hopefully we can bring them up quick and when we don't have those growing pains, because honestly we're not in a position to be having too many more 6 and 6 years. We got to get back up to where we were the last few seasons.
You mentioned earlier Andrew Maxwell and Connor Cook, and kind of there's not really confidence in Maxwell. Do you think there could still potentially be some room for some shifting in the number one spot for quarterback, or set for now?
Right now, I think we're probably set. I think a lot of things are going to be decided in camp that starts Friday. So we'll see. You know, maybe Cook makes a play for that number one spot. But at the same time, right now, I think it's Maxwell's job to lose. But if last year was any indication, it could go in any number of directions. I mean, they've got Tyler O'Connor, and Damian Terry, a freshman, coming in. And they're looking for more versatility from the quarterback position, and if Maxwell isn't the guy, I think after last season, I think Coach D'Antonio is going to be quicker to kind of, you know, pull the starter and get somebody new in there and try something different, because I don't know how many more games fans can sit through that are 17-14 with 75 yards of passing. I think, you know, fans are going to be texting even quicker if we're, not moving the ball again this season. So I think, you know, I think we'll be quicker to make a change. But for now, it's Maxwell's job.
Now, looking at the Big Ten as a whole, we avoid Ohio State this year.
Thankfully.
What are some of the other challenges that we are going to be facing?
Well, yeah, I mean, the schedule definitely sets up nicely for a bounce back season. We trade Ohio State and Wisconsin for Purdue and Illinois, who are traditionally obviously not quite as strong. Purdue's got a new coach. Illinois is, I don't know what they're doing. They're trying to dig themselves out of a pretty big hole. As far as the schedule is concerned, we've got road games. You know, all the road games are tough. At Notre Dame, out of conference, at Iowa, who's, you know, that's traditionally a house of horrors for us, at Nebraska, where, you know, we haven't even looked impressive against Nebraska at all, and at Northwestern. So nothing is going to be easy as far as that's concerned. And then last year they couldn't get any, home wins at all in conference. So it's going to be protecting your home field. That's the most important thing. I don't think we can take anything for granted, especially after last year. You got to really do it all.
Matt Ludke is the production assistant for Current Sports, and that's just the first of many football previews that we're going to be having with our partners at Current Sports. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Mark Bayshore will be back, thank goodness. We're also going to take a look at the role of the USDA's Rural Development Office plays in supporting small farming communities in Michigan. And local author Steve Miller writes about the Motor City's music legacy in his book, Detroit Rock City. All that and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by M3 Group, a full-service branding agency as well as publisher of Greater Lansing Business Monthly and Capital Area Women's Lifestyle Magazine. Information on services and publications at m3group.biz. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.